Here he is with 9 stone 12, 136 pounds as a four-year-old in the Melbourne Cup of 1930. 10,000 pounds sterling that race was worth, and the best stayers in Australia were engaged, but Firelap simply played with them. Aye, it's like he's taking candy from a baby. Firelap wins.
He's a phenomenal galloper. I think the best horse I've ever seen and ever rode.
The Red Terror, the greatest horse in the world.
In 1930, Firelap won 11 races in 11 weeks. Nothing compares with that.
We're going to lose you, and we're going to miss you. Good luck, Firelap. Australia's with you.
Going to America, Firelap was sent into the most treacherous racing environment that has ever existed.
But Firelap's got it. Come on, Firelap. Firelap, you beauty.
And then, at the height of his racing career, Firelap suddenly dies.
The Yanks killed him.
I rang Dad and said, oh, I'm going to Canberra. I said, I'll have a look at Firelap's heart while I'm there. And that's when he said, well, that'll be clever because it's not Firelap's heart, it's draft horses. Well, I just said to him, are you joking?
All the evidence is right there in front of us, in plain sight. I'm Kerry Nagara, and this is Killing Firelap, a forensic investigation. Episode 4, High Hopes, November 1931, Sydney, Australia. Tommy Woodcock is a very proud and happy young man. Earlier in the year, he had married his Sydney sweetheart, Emma Jane Bone, and now at 26, he is taking Firelap, Australia's most loved and possibly the world's greatest racehorse, to America to run in the world's richest horse race, the Agua Caliente Handicap, at a classy resort on the Mexican border. Most importantly, he's been promoted from being Firelap's strapper to his trainer. Previously in 1928, when Tommy's boss, trainer Harry Telford, bought Firelap unseen for businessman Dave Davis, relying solely on his bloodline from an auction in New Zealand, he arrived on the Sydney docks a sad, underfed colt with warts all over his head. He was ungainly and not at all the thoroughbred yearling the men had expected to receive. On seeing Firelap, Dave Davis was annoyed and impatient with Harry, believing the trainer must be out of his mind. To say Dave didn't want anything to do with Firelap is something of an understatement. Yet Harry convinced Dave to have faith, proposing that he would lease the colt from him to offset the purchase. Forgoing training fees from Dave, the two men then agreed on splitting any earnings, two-thirds to Harry and one-third to Dave, something Dave would soon come to regret. Tommy may officially be Firelap's strapper, but in reality, he is Firelap's trainer. Firelap acts badly for the battler trainer, Harry Telford, who had earlier almost given up on the immature Firelap. Harry is cruel, inflicting a relentless and punishing training regime on the young horse. Firelap retaliates and won't let Harry near him without a quarrel. He bites Harry and rips the shirts from the stable boys' backs. As Harry makes no headway training Firelap with this rigorous training regimen, up and down sandhills, he decides that Firelap is lazy. In fact, the young horse is exhausted. Harry has all but given up when he asks Tommy Woodcock, the talented young horse handler who was making a name for himself around Sydney's Randwick stables, to give him a hand to see if he can do anything with the horse. Firelap soon makes it clear that there is no one he will have by his side other than Tommy Woodcock. When Tommy takes Firelap into his confidence, the unruly, bad-tempered thoroughbred horse becomes a placid pony. With Tommy, Firelap is a lamb who, after enduring Harry's unkindness, responds to the young trainer's gentle methods with an unyielding desire to please. Bobby, as he is fondly known around the stables, is a cheeky yet subdued pet who responds positively to everything Tommy asks him to do. He works him daily, grooms him until his chestnut red coat shines, feeds him morning and night, and fusses over every aspect of his health and well-being. There is nowhere else Tommy would rather be than with Firelap. There is no other job he would rather have. Tommy Woodcock's life is now heavy with responsibility and full of promise. Firelap flourishes under Tommy's gentle handling. After his first race losses, Tommy realises Farlap is a stayer and teaches him to win from behind the field in a style that will become legendary. Farlap maintains his dislike of Harry Telford, who cannot handle his amazing champion. So it is that Harry becomes very dependent on the now indispensable Tommy Woodcock. By autumn of 1929, Tommy and Farlap are an astounding team. As a respite from the tough handling from Harry Telford, Farlap appears to perform just for Tommy, rewarding the young strapper's technique, kindness and racing tactics with win after win, protecting Farlap as much as he can from his overzealous trainer and part owner Dave Davis. Harry famously complains that Farlap won't pee unless Tommy tells him to. Tommy said Farlap always tried to help him and to please him. There is a mutual intelligence and bond that forms between the pair. They are inseparable companions. In 3 short years, from 1929 to 1932, Farlap wins an amazing 37 races. In 2 short years between 1929 and 1931, Farlap's owners have raced him 39 times, and he has won every race except 4. Between rests out of town, he is racing an average of once a fortnight, with thousands of miles of travelling thrown in. The result is that Farlap becomes so outweighted, over-raced and over-trained, that in the 1931 Melbourne Cup, carrying 63 kilos, that's over 138 pounds, jockey Jim Pike pulls Farlap up and allows him to come home in 8th place. In this race that stops a nation, little did Australians know that this is the last time they will see their wonder horse perform. To go out under such inauspicious circumstances is a great shame on Farlap's owners and the Victorian Racing Club that insist Farlap run to secure their course attendances. In fact, 10,000 more people come to the Cup in 1931 than in the previous year. The massive crowd comes only to see their mighty Farlap. From boom to bust. When the Roaring Twenties ended, the new year turned into a punishing new decade that saw the world out of work. By 1930, Australians are suffering the harsh effects of the vast economic depression. Families are broken, men defeated, children go hungry. In Australia, these people with their backs against the wall watch as Farlap goes from loser to champion, galloping from the back of the field to win time and time again. Farlap becomes the inspiration for a nation. Tommy and Farlap are taken into people's hearts and feted everywhere they appear. They are not welcome by the criminal underworld of bookmakers, gamblers and crooks, though, who have already taken gunshots at Farlap and regularly sent hate mail and death threats to Harry Telford. Farlap's successes are their financial losses. Dave Davis is a cunning gambler who joins owner and big punter Eric Connolly to create one of the biggest betting scandals in Australian history. Together, they manipulate the 1930 Melbourne Cup Caulfield Cup double, scratching Farlap from the Caulfield Cup at the last possible moment, having bet on another horse, Amunis, for the win at great odds at 20-1. Dave takes in a few lucky punters on his inside circle, including a lady punter, Mrs. Maud Vandenberg, and Harry Telford. Inside punter Eric Connolly alone made $200,000. The bookies' losses were substantial, and some went broke in that one devastating day of the Melbourne Cup in 1930. In 1931, Farlap's prize money is astronomical in a racing career that spanned just 3 short years. With their combined prize winnings and betting coups, Dave Davis and Harry Telford make an absolute fortune on Farlap. In a global depression, this is even more impressive. Their winnings alone in the same races today would net them over $15 million. This has never been equaled by any other horse in racing's history. Adding to that sum, the amount they win in their deceitfully manipulated betting manoeuvres is anyone's guess. Dave Davis and Harry Telford exploit their champion to the maximum, racing him hard and often, allowing him to carry ridiculous and unprecedented heavy weights. Farlap, though, remains unbeatable. His rankings at 141 are still the world's highest. His feats are incomparable to today's champion horses. There is simply no comparison for what Farlap achieved. Yet there are no bonuses given out at the Telford Stables to stable hands and strappers with each handsome win. The environment at Harry Telford's training stables is very strict and somewhat mean-spirited. Harry encourages Dave Davis not to spoil the boys. Also mean-spirited are the heartless men who run the snobbish Victorian Racing Club, the VRC, who make Farlap carry an outrageous 150 pounds, that's 68.2 kilograms or 10.7 stone, in the 1931 Melbourne Cup, run over 2 long miles, meant that he carried 56 pounds, that's 25.5 kilos or 4 stone more than the winning horse. Taking on the world. Harry Telford and Dave Davis do not see eye to eye on what to do with Farlap's racing career once he is outweighted in Australia. Dave Davis is an American citizen who keeps a house in San Francisco and is keen to take his horse home in a blaze of glory as the owner of the world's greatest racehorse. James Crofton, part owner of the prestigious Aguascalientes Racing Club, just over the border in Mexico, makes a special trip to Australia in November to watch Farlap lose in the 1931 Melbourne Cup. Unplaced, he pulls up very badly. He sees that Farlap's owners have a problem on their hands with their outweighted champion, and he is ready to exploit it. A master strategist, Crofton is on a mission to bring the great Farlap to his club as a superstar who can attract large crowds and reinvigorate his ailing, depression-affected business. The wily Crofton seizes the opportunity and seduces Dave Davis with an offer of an all-expenses-paid trip to the US, together with an unimaginable prize of $100,000 to the winner of the Aguascalientes Handicap, which they are billing as the world's richest horse race. Coming up in the following March, Dave is keen to go. Harry, on the other hand, prefers, if at all, the idea of taking Farlap to England to race against the world's best horses on the smooth grass turf in the genteel aristocratic surrounds of Royal Ascot. However, Dave Davis cannot resist and is determined to go to the US and wins the argument. Ascot can wait. Against Harry Telford's best instincts, Farlap will race instead in America, where the tracks are stony and dirt hard, and the gangsters, race riggers, and mob bookmakers operate as a law unto themselves. Both men are financially tough operators, and they are seduced by the amazing amount of money on offer from the shifty characters who own the Aguascalientes Club, all expenses paid. You would think that having made their fortune, Dave Davis and Harry Telford would be content to have Farlap rested as a showpiece and bask in his reflected glory. Dave Davis and Harry Telford have already made more money from this one champion animal than their vast dreams ever imagined. They could easily let the hard-working Farlap retire to serene pastures to live out the rest of his fated life in peace. After all, there is only so much money that one man can spend. But retiring Farlap is not on Dave Davis's agenda. Unlike Harry Telford, Davis is not a lover of horses. He simply sees Farlap as a money-making machine. Davis sees it as his right to maximise the profits. And so Dave Davis is easily lured to America by these so-called border barons who own the Aguascalientes Racing Club. The border barons are later described as risk-taking, well-heeled, charming sons of bitches who work the vulnerable underbelly of the law to get rich. Charming indeed. No longer a struggling battler trainer, Harry Telford moves south from his Sydney base and sinks all his profits from Farlap's wins into a breeding stud and stables at Brayside in the lush paddocks south of Melbourne. Harry is obsessed with thoroughbred bloodlines and is convinced he can breed another Farlap. As such, he is too preoccupied with horses in training and at stud to take Farlap to America. Harry is also supporting his wife through the sad illness and ultimately the death of their baby daughter. It is no time for travel. In any case, Harry concedes that Tommy Woodcock is effectively Farlap's trainer, as Harry has little control over the champion. On Friday, November 20, 1931, after the successful yet grueling spring racing campaign in Sydney and Melbourne, with Dave Davis's promise to Tommy of $1,000 for the trip and $1,000 for a Farlap win, Tommy and his horse set off together from the Sydney docks for New Zealand, en route to California and Mexico, in the hull of a rickety old steamer, the Ulamaroa, or as Tommy called it, the Wanganui, an animal transporter on the Monoway line. Tommy is well aware of the crooks and shady characters who would harm Farlap and think little of having him killed in Australia. Yet leaving his country's corrupt racing and gambling scene behind, he cannot yet imagine the magnitude of the crime-ridden nation of the early 1930s that he is headed for. In 1932, American gangsters and mafia families are amassing unheard-of wealth, smuggling alcohol and operating illegal betting parlours and brothels. They take advantage of the prohibition on alcohol and gambling during this record economic meltdown. It is a time when desperate men and thugs will do almost anything for money. Kidnapping, murder, and extortion at unprecedented levels are reported daily in the US press. It is the era of forbidden Hollywood, where gangster movies with bad dames packing six-shooters thrive, titillating audiences, art imitating life and life imitating art. If Tommy Woodcock thought that being shot at by bookie gangsters in 1930 due to his boss's gambling fixes was bad enough, what awaits him in California and Mexico is so very, very much darker. The best holiday I ever had, just me and me horse. California, here I come. Tommy is having the holiday of his life, now that they are headed to San Francisco. Tommy thinks of his lovely new wife Emma and the time they had alone, resting Farlap on Harry Telford's bookmaker friend Sol Green's property in the lush countryside a couple of hours from Melbourne. Enjoying a cottage to themselves, Emma thinks of this as the best time in their life, a rare holiday. Tommy is excited by the amazing opportunity in America that he hopes will set him up for life.
A great thing for me to think, you know, I'd go to America, the trainer, the one of the best horses in the world.
Even though this first leg of their trip is in rough cattle class, Tommy is in his element. It is not an auspicious start to their immense journey, though. Tommy and Farlap are housed down in the hull with an assortment of rodeo and circus animals, including a donkey and a camel, for 5 days and four nights. The air is stuffy and the putrid hull is washed out from time to time with seawater.
Nobody's ever said anything about Farlap travelling to New Zealand. And they've always said, oh, he travelled to America, but nobody ever said really how he travelled to New Zealand. Wanganui, that was the old horse boat, and there was anything you can mention down there. There was donkeys, camels, mules. I think there's only two horses, I think. It was Farlap and another horse. We get out to sea a little bit. Oh, it got pretty rough.
Harry Telford arranged for Tommy and Farlap to stay for a month with his brother Hugh Telford near Wellington. The two horse lovers get on really well. Tommy is relaxed with the affable Huey, who is a breath of fresh air after enduring the hardships of life around the gruff and stingy Harry Telford. Huey is almost the opposite of his brother. After spending a laugh-a-minute Christmas together, the month is soon up and they set off on the next leg of the long trip to America. The sea voyage from Wellington to California is a completely different experience from the first rough Australasian crossing. As the owners of the Caliente Club are footing the bill, Harry Telford spares no expense in setting up a comfortable stable and exercising ring on board the Monoway. Making friends with the old bosun, Tommy is in his element. A relaxing holiday is just what he needs after the stresses of Farlap's intense racing campaign, and unknown to Tommy, to prepare for the severe challenges he is about to face. Leaving on the steamer from New Zealand on December 29, 1931, with Tommy and Farlap, is the vet Bill Nielsen and the track rider Jack Cashy Martin. The jockey Billy Elliott will join them in the next few weeks. The opportunity of an overseas trip like this is so rare for anyone working in a racing stable. The excitement is palpable. And what a trip it is. They sail out on the beautiful steamer toward the crystal blue seas of the Pacific, toward an exotic world of racing, with prospects that once they might only have dreamt of. Bill Nielsen is feeling pretty pleased with himself too. Here he was a practicing horse vet, with no medical qualifications other than his hard-earned experience around the racing traps and farms of Australian rural New South Wales. Yet Harry Telford and Dave Davis have enough confidence in the lay vet to send him out to America with Farlap. Strictly speaking, Bill is known around the traps as a horse doctor, but is able to register on the government veterinary records due to this hands-on experience, rather than as the holder of a degree in veterinary science. Farlap and his Australian party arrived 2.5 weeks later in San Francisco on January 15, 1932, and for a few days they stable at Tanforan Race Club. The owner of Tanforan is John W. Marchbank, a local wheeler and dealer who operates on the shady side of the law with his own casinos. He pays off authorities so he can operate on the San Mateo Peninsula without interruption by local police. The corrupt Marchbank is itching to have Farlap stabled at Tanforan to better attract the best US horses in exhibition races. Dave has a house in San Francisco and is befriended by Edward Perry, who with his wife Suzanne owns the luxurious horse ranch nearby, Menlo Park in Atherton, on the stunning Bay Peninsula. Ed insists on hosting the Australians and he generously invites them to move into the comfort of his stables. Tommy prefers Farlap to be at this more isolated private location at Menlo Park, which annoys Marchbank, who wants his stables in the media spotlight, hosting the Wonder Horse from Australia. The owners of the Agua Caliente Club play their cards well. Once Farlap is halfway across the Pacific Ocean to California, they cut the 100,000 cup prize money in half. A furious Dave Davis can do nothing but accept this. Of course, $50,000 is still a very handsome purse, depression or not. As Tommy would later say,
"Really, half apple's better than none, isn't it?"
Dave Davis returns to his native country of the United States as the proud owner of his wonder from down under, Farlap, dubbed the Aussie Antelope. The US sports press are not short on headline-grabbing alliteration on Farlap's arrival. Dave had left the US with nothing. Arriving in Australia as an outsider, he dreamed of returning home a wealthy, sought-after businessman. In Australia, the racist Melbourne Club would not have Jews as members, so Dave, despite his success, remained well and truly an outsider. Rather than put up his finger to the snobbish culture, he hankered after their acceptance. This shrewd, wily character is determined to show his fellow citizens and his hometown crowd what he is made of. Menlo Park is a stunningly beautiful horse ranch and stud, specialising in standard breed harness races. Sitting on the San Mateo Peninsula south of San Francisco, it's a showpiece of equine splendour. No expense has been spared in creating the picturesque pastures and the five-star stables with loft accommodation for trainers and stable hands above the horse stalls. Ed also loans Dave Davis his wife Suzanne's luxurious horse bus to take Farlap on the 1,200-mile return journey to the Agua Caliente Club, 2 miles over the border in Tijuana, Mexico. On January 25, 1932, they set off on the road trip to Mexico, arriving in Tijuana on January 27. The bus is gaily decorated with paintings of Suzanne's favourite horses. Down Mexico Way. Arriving in Tijuana, Tommy can feel the corruption and vice hovering all around them.
I was a terrible worried little fella, I can tell you.
This is in keeping with the Caliente's owners, the so-called border barons, and they need to feed the press with stories of Farlap's racing form and any other antics they can manufacture. To their irritation, Tommy immediately rejects this offer and chooses an old rundown stable at the back of the course, near some sandhills, out of the way of the press and onlookers. When Tommy talked of Agua Caliente, he said,
Mexico wasn't quite as nice as California, I can tell you. When we got there, I didn't like the scenes very well. Of course, I was up with a horse, slept alongside of him up there. Two big Mexican guards were there, and they had two big six-shooters on each side of them, which I didn't feel very happy about that, but they had to have them, I suppose. Anyhow, nobody ever went near the horse. They wouldn't let anybody come anywhere near the horse.
Harry Telford had given Tommy very specific directions as to how to race Farlap on the rough Mexican dirt tracks. There were no grass turfs on any of the American courses, so Harry had his farrier make some horseshoes with rubber cushioning inserts, especially for Farlap to race on the hard tracks. But at Caliente, the local farrier strongly advised Tommy against using the Australian-made shoes, warning he'll bust his foot open. Yet Tommy had faith in the rubber-reinforced shoes and used them against the seasoned expert's advice. Sadly, this is exactly what happens the first time that Tommy races Farlap at a fast pace around the track. A full quarter of his hoof broke off. Tommy now has a severely injured horse and a hyped-up race to win in just a few weeks. Farlap's vet, Bill Nielsen, treats the injury with some wrapping material called wax end, which immediately proves ineffective. The wax end wrapping that Bill applies so confidently unraveled while Farlap was still galloping. A disaster. Tommy recalls,
the blood was running out of his foot. He busted this wax end stuff.
Luckily, Tommy makes friends with a blacksmith on the course, a Canadian, Jimmy Smith.
I said, Jimmy, what can you do for him? He said, look, he said, I've done it before. He said, it's turned out reasonably well. I said, what's that? He said, cut that bit of foot right off. I said, yes. I said, it's all right. So he said, get your vet to deaden him up there. And he said, I'll cut it off for you. And he said, well, does your vet want to cut it off? No, I said, you cut it off. So anyhow, he said, right. So anyhow, he cut this foot off. And all you could see under when he cut this big bit of foot off was just like a bit of red raw, like if you cut your fingernail off. And I said to Jimmy, I said, now what next? He said, look, he said, get some iodine. And he said, paint it two or three times a day with iodine. I said, all right. So I done what I was told. And he said, you'll have to keep him off the turns. Don't work him on the track here. I said, no. And fortunate enough, there was a sort of sandy dirt road where we had the stables. And I used to work him up and down this sand road for about 5 miles and 5 miles back nearly. And when the foot healed up, the little blacksmith come. He brought his little forge along, and he made him a beautiful set of bar plates. And he said, try them. So anyhow, that's what I did. I tried them, walked him along the road, backwards and forwards. I spent hours. So the day came and I called him in, the blacksmith in again. I had great faith in him. I said, time's getting close. Do you think I'll be able to give him a little bit of fast work? And he said, looked at his foot, and he said, I think you'd be quite right. He said, I think you'd stand up to it all right. So anyhow, one morning early, I took him down to the track. It hardly break a day. The track was already ironed out and everything else, no horses on it. So anyhow, I took him down and worked him. Oh, gee, he did work well too. He just flew on the last 3 furlongs.
Tommy says from the time they arrived in Mexico, they have bad luck, and the local press is relentlessly critical of his soft training methods, and for not working Farlap at the Caliente track. As Tommy recounted,
I copped it a lot though, when I wouldn't take the track and working. Oh gee, I got criticised, and of course the press was on to Mr Davis, and he come out, and the vet wasn't on my side much either. He was sort of inclined to want to take the horse down and work him before he was fitting, because me going over his head a little bit, taking notice of the farrier more than him, but you know, he was good friends and that, but he wasn't quite happy about the situation, taking sort of things out of his hands. But he was having a good time there, so I don't suppose he worried that much. Mrs. Davis, she come and she's always on my side, Mrs. Davis. And I used to say, don't worry, Mrs. Davis, we'll get him there. We'll be all right. I can get him a little bit better than what he is now. He'll be right. So she always went home with a smile, Mrs. Davis.
It was a stroke of luck then that Jimmy Smith, the talented blacksmith, was on hand to save the day. Farlap's injured hoof heals quickly under Jimmy's instructions. Tommy ignores Bill Nielsen's advice after this episode in Mexico and now makes his own decisions. No doubt Bill Nielsen sees this as something of a snub by Tommy, who has obviously lost confidence in the horse doctor. Tommy finds the criminal atmosphere surrounding Aguacaliente Caliente uncomfortable and the armed guards appointed to his stable unnerving. He sleeps next to Farlap's stall and goes nowhere. The rest of the Australian party have a ball as they are feted at the Caliente Casino by movie stars and the wealthy American glitterati, who revel in the atmosphere of legal alcohol and the anything-goes gambling mood. But it was not all movie stars and glamour at the Aguacaliente Racing Club. There was a shootout and attempted robbery the night before the big race day. Malicious race fixers were cunningly assessing Farlap and his injured hoof. Where would their bets go? In the meantime, Dave Davis and his group of insiders had laid out a small fortune right across the country for a win on Farlap. Would this be Farlap's undoing? I'm Kerry Nagara, and this is Killing Farlap, a forensic investigation. Technical producer is Richard DiGregorio.
Hi, Richard here. We'll be putting up 2 episodes every week of Kerry's amazing investigation, Killing Farlap. There are 9 episodes in all, so make sure you subscribe and the episodes will automatically come into your podcast library. We welcome any feedback and comments and hope if you enjoy the podcast, you will give us a star rating and review. Thanks for listening.